Six Figure Developer Podcast. I'm John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.
And with us today, we have Robert C. Martin. Robert C. Martin, aka Uncle Bob, been a software professional since 1970 and an international software consultant since 1990. He's author of Clean Code, The Clean Coder, Agile Software Development, and many more books. Welcome, Uncle Bob.
Good to be here.
Bob, you want to tell us how you got started and what led you to a life in software development?
Oh, my goodness. Sure. I got into this goofy software business in 1964. I was 12 years old. My mother bought me a small plastic computer. This machine consisted of three flip-flops, which were made out of plastic. They slid back and forth between two states. And six AND gates, which were metal rods that could slip into the grooves on the three flip-flops if those grooves were not blocked by little tubes that you could place on pegs. The little metal rods would sense all three flip-flops at the same time, therefore they were AND gates. And if the AND gate fired, if the little metal rod managed to slip into the grooves on the flip-flops, then it would engage a mechanism that would change the state of one or more of the flip-flops. So this was a 3-bit finite state machine that you could program through 8 possible transitions. And because you could program it, you could get it to do simple things like count. You could count from 0 up to 7 and then back to 0 again. You could make it count down. That was a different arrangement of the tubes on the pegs on the flip-flops, but you could make it count down. You can make it add 2 bits, giving you a sum and a carry bit. You could make it subtract. You could make it multiply. There were many other little things that you could do. And I went through all of the experiments in the manual, and they were fine. You know, I got them all to work, but I was left deeply unsatisfied because I could not make this machine do what I wanted it to do, and I had a program in mind for it. I noticed that at the end of the manual for this little machine, there was a paragraph that said, if you would like the advanced programming manual, send in a dollar and a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we will send you the advanced programming manual. So I did this. I sent in my dollar and the envelope, and it took 6 weeks, but in the mail came the book, this little manual that was the advanced programming manual. This, I still have it. I got it out and I read it a few years ago. It is perhaps the most cogent description of Boolean algebra written for a 12-year-old that I can imagine. It immediately went through Boolean variables, the truth tables, Venn diagrams, Carnot maps, all the functions, AND/OR, XOR, XNOR, etc. Finally got into Boolean algebra itself, dissociative property, distributive property of AND over OR, distributive property of OR over AND, De Morgan's theorem, the whole nine yards. And then when it was done with that, and this was about 20 pages in, it said, okay, now you've got a program you want to write for this little machine. You write down the truth table of all the state transitions, translate them into Boolean equations, reduce those Boolean equations to lowest terms using the Boolean algebra that we just taught you. And now here's a little table that will tell you how to take the resultant Boolean equations and turn them into pegs or tubes on the pegs. And so I did this. I had this program in mind. It was called Mr. Patterson's Computerized Gate. I wrote down the state transition table, I turned it into Boolean equations, reduced them to lowest terms, put the tubes on the pegs, cycled the machine, and that little machine did exactly what I wanted it to do, and I knew what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I wanted to be a programmer. That's how I got into this goofy business.
Same story from thousands of little boys and girls across the world, right?
I hope so. There is nowadays an email group of Friends of DigiComp 1, which are all the people my age who played with that little plastic computer back in 1964.
Now, you gave us the solid principles. You gave us clean code, and you've been a proponent for test-driven development and produce great books and great video series. How has that become a passion for yours in particular? How did you become interested in clean code and professionalism and helping progress the industry in that manner?
I've been doing this job of writing code for over 50 years. And in that time, I have come to appreciate that software can be done much better than it is being done, that it can be done at much less cost, that it can truly be soft. We can make changes that are, we can keep our software changeable and flexible. We can actually fulfill the promise that software made so long ago. That we can behave in an honorable and professional way, not just to keep our code organized and clean and disciplined, but also in a professional and ethical way in our role in society. The problem that I foresee is that our society has come to depend on us in ways that they don't understand and we don't understand. But nothing happens in our society anymore unless software is somehow involved. And that means that we, the people who write that software, have a huge responsibility to write it well and keep the mechanisms of our society running properly. That at least is a summary of why I'm interested in.
We've gotten ourselves into this predicament because we said we know how to develop software. We know how to do it. And now it's up to us to take on that ownership and make sure that we deliver it and deliver on that promise. Was that the catalyst behind the original meeting where the Agile Manifesto was created?
The catalyst there, it certainly was part of it. There was a definite movement in that group towards craftsmanship and high quality and responsibility and professionalism. But I'm not going to say that that was the prime motivation. Prime motivation of the Agile meeting at Snowbird in 2001 was to get away from the heavyweight processes that we'd been saddled with for 30 years. Most of us had lived through the horror scenes of trying to conform to those heavyweight processes, and had seen them fail over and over again, and had come to the conclusion that was the wrong approach to take, and began to look at these lighter weight options like extreme programming and Scrum and feature-driven development and so on. And we thought, you know, there is a cause here. We could help lead the software community out from the burden of that heavyweight process. Apparently that worked.
Speaking of Scrum, since you brought it up, I remember watching a video where you kind of insinuated and almost said that Scrum as it exists now is essentially just a money-making machine, or at least that was a huge part of it. Do you remember the video I'm talking about? You were like at a conference or something.
No, I don't remember the video or the conference. I don't remember exactly saying that, but it is a sentiment that I have expressed in a number of places. And it's not quite fair to say that Scrum is solely a money making machine, but certainly a part of it became a way for consultants and contractors to become certified Scrum Masters and make a lot of money, or make some money anyway. I don't know if it was ever a lot. And to some extent, that diluted the message. I should say, however, that the whole notion of certified Scrum Masters was also the catalyst that drove Agile across the chasm, that got business interested in Scrum and in Agile development. So it's a two-sided sword. It's a two-edged sword. There was a positive side to it and a negative side to it. Nowadays, I think the negative side probably outweighs the positive side.
So because of that impression, and I have the same feelings. They think that oh, we'll just do Scrum and that'll solve it. What kind of process do you follow with your son at Eighth Light?
Okay, so I'm not at Eighth Light anymore, and neither is my son. But when we were, I have often been called the owner of Eighth Light, which was never the case. But my name was so closely associated with it that it's reasonable to talk about the fact that I'm not there anymore. And even when I was there, I was just kind of a figurehead. I was just, you know, master craftsman, and I went and did a few talks and stuff like that. You had asked me a specific question, which was, you know, what was the process we used when we were writing software, when my son and I would write software together, or when any of the object mentors and I would write software together, or whenever I just write software with anybody, what process do I use? And the answer to that is a variant on extreme programming. And by variant, I mean whatever feels good to me at the time, using the disciplines of extreme programming. So if it's a very simple project, I might not do all of the practices of extreme programming. For example, there may not be a customer, so I can't use the on-site customer. Maybe we are not going to do something big enough to have acceptance tests, so I won't do acceptance tests. But tuned for the project, I would do something like extreme programming. Certainly, I would do a fair bit of pair programming. I would always do test-driven development for the vast majority of the code. I would always keep the design as simple as possible. Et cetera.
I was just curious because it's a constant struggle to find a direction for process that really works. The business and the developers have vastly different ideas about what they want to happen.
Well, I mean, the problem here is faith in process. If you have a faith in process, you're going to fail. What we need is faith in the people. And provide a process that everybody kind of looks at and goes, yeah, I think that'll work. And they'll follow the process tuned to the project they're using. Certain disciplines are very valuable. Pair programming is very valuable. Test-driven development is. Acceptance testing is. A lot of these disciplines can be applied in a very valuable way. But to have faith in a process is to put your faith in completely the wrong thing.
The way that I normally like to look at it is pick a direction. And I think it was either Kent Beck or Martin Fowler was on another podcast. And they mentioned that they went through a period and it was like maybe a year where they didn't do anything without knowing the pattern behind why they were doing it. And then they measured which patterns were better than other patterns for them in certain situations. So not quite that strict, but I usually like to try something for a little while, measure it, try something else for a little while, measure it, and then head down the path of the one that was more efficient. But it's kind of difficult to get the business to play along with that.
You know, so why does the business have to play along with that? It's pretty much a decision that the developers can make themselves. The business goes to the developers and says, hey guys, build us a project. And the developers have to decide amongst themselves the best way to get that done. And if the developers decide they're going to try a discipline for a while and measure it and then see if it works, well, that's their business. It's not the business's business to get involved with that. So that's another mistake that we as programmers often make. We try and ask permission from people who do not have the competence to make the decision. We ask the business, can we pair program? That's a nonsensical question to ask a manager who doesn't know anything about software. And of course, the manager is going to feel offended by that because the the end result is that the programmers are making the manager take the risk. If it fails, it was the manager's fault for allowing it. So most of our development teams ought to be, you know, facing the fact that they have to make these decisions themselves without permission and ask forgiveness later, perhaps. But it's not the business's job to make these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, I'm 100% behind you on the things that the developer can control internally. I'm talking more about the way the requirements are written or the level of detail for certain aspects of things that are not within the developer control, QA processes and business analyst type processes. Those are a lot harder to iterate on.
They are, because they've been taken out of the control of the development team. And the reason they were taken out of the control of the development team is that historically, development teams have done a terrible job at that kind of stuff. So that is yet another thing that we are going, as developers, we are going to have to earn back the trust of our organizations so that those kinds of activities, especially QA, come back under our control.
So it's about bringing the true, if we're talking Scrum, then it's about bringing the true Scrum team together with the mixed tasks of business analysis, coding, developing, testing, delivery, all under the same umbrella of the same team.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
There was a video, you'd given a talk to a group, and it's made the rounds on YouTube, entitled something along the lines of, "We will not ship shit."
Okay, yes. All right.
I believe the bulk of the talk is around professionalism, and like you mentioned, that it's up to developers to make the decisions of how we do our work and how we deliver, but it's also up to us to ensure that we're doing the right things and delivering the right things and ensuring that we're delivering quality and completeness. During that talk, you had mentioned the possibility or the threat of at some point in the future having a regulatory body or some kind of governing body that would oversee software development. Do you see that as a true potential for the future, or how might that come about, where we're all in agreement as to what quality is, and you know, all in agreement that we are not putting people's lives in danger as things continue to become more and more automated? What are your thoughts about the future of software development?
It's one of those talks that I give very frequently about the future of software development, and I lay out the scenario that at some date in the future, and probably not very far from now, some poor software idiot is going to do some dumb thing and kill 10,000 people. And it wouldn't be that hard to imagine what the scenario would be. It's nowadays there's software in so many things, and it controls so much of our lives, that the idea that one little bug could kill 10,000 people has become realistic. And when that occurs, and it will occur at some point in time, when that occurs, the politicians of the world will legislate. They'll be expected to get some kind of control over these software people who can't seem to write code that protects people's lives. And the politicians will legislate rules about how we programmers are allowed to behave. And they may dictate the kind of languages we have to use and the kinds of platforms we have to use and what processes we have to follow and what signatures we have to get, what books we have to read, what degrees we have to get. All of that could become a matter of law. And so my recommendation to the software world is that we have to get there first. Because when the event occurs, and 10,000 people are killed by a software error, if we are there with a set of ethics and rules and standards, then we can offer those to the politicians of the world, and the politicians of the world will turn those things into laws rather than inventing their own.
I think we've probably already seen the beginnings of some of these potential issues at the risk of being sued. we've probably already seen problems through Toyota and their issues with their throttle, Tesla with their issues of their self-driving cars. There was an internet outage. Twitter and others were greatly affected by an IoT DDoS attack a number of months ago. So
I remember that.
You know, we're already seeing the potential for even larger problems. Taking it a step further on self-governing and self-policing, you know, who's going to step up? I would assume it's up to all of us to step up, but at some point, people are going to look upwards to a singular person or a group of people. You know, is there going to be a nonprofit organization? What would be the ideal scenario to avoid potential government regulation? And
that's a very difficult question to answer. My hope is for a body like the Agile Alliance to take that on. Some people have suggested perhaps the ACM could do it or the IEEE. My own belief is that those bodies are too old and too stodgy to take on a role like that. I kind of hope the Agile Alliance would. I'm not sure that the Agile Alliance is really in a position to do that, though. Someone in the Agile community, some body in the Agile community, would be a good possibility for that. There's another way this could work, though. Rather than a single body attempting to formulate the standards and ethics for all software developers, it might be better for guilds to form. And we already see that. Eighth Light, we've mentioned them before, has a set of standards, a set of ethics. If you're an Eighth Light developer, you follow these rules, and there's no question about it. And if we have a number of companies like that, or groups of companies like that, that follow a set of standards and rules, then there can be a kind of competition that weeds out the good and the bad rules and eventually coalesces into a professional organization. Maybe that's the way it'll happen.
I had recently moved from a city where there were about 3 open positions per developer into a city where there are only about 2 open positions per developer. So I know it's a constant struggle for companies and for recruiting agencies to find qualified candidates.
Yes.
To fill the vacant positions. The difficulty there is that often some of the requirements for particular positions are laxed, or people are brought on in the guise of training them to particular standards, and then through whatever means or processes that happen, maybe some of the training doesn't happen. Or what should we look for in developing those candidates and setting minimum standards of requirements for positions?
You said it very well. The demand for computer programmers remains ridiculously high. Regardless of how many programmers there are, we always seem to need more of them. This is a function of the fact that more and more of the mechanisms of society are being put under software control. If you look back in time and measure the growth curve of software developers, we had one software developer in 1946, and that was Alan Turing. And now, I don't know how many there are now, but it's probably in the tens of millions, maybe even 100 million. And it depends on if you count the VBA programmers, of course. But if you if you plot that curve, that's an exponential curve. And it has a doubling rate on the order of one every 5 years. So the number of programmers in the world doubles every 5. And this has this implication. Half the programmers in the world have less than 5 years experience. And this will always be true as long as the doubling rate continues. And so we cannot form groups of programmers with sufficient old people in them. There aren't enough experienced people to train the youngsters coming in. And therefore, the youngsters believe they know everything because they look around and all they see are people their age. it's very difficult to inculcate the values of software development that I think are necessary when there's this massive growth in software developers. Now, that growth has to end pretty soon because there aren't a lot more doublings that we can have. Probably that's going to slow down, and at which point we'll start to develop a group of developers with longer and longer sets of experience, and maybe we can begin to adopt some values and standards.
And since we've been recording this podcast, there have been 3 new releases of JavaScript frameworks, so there's more to keep up with since then.
Well, thankfully, you don't actually need any qualifications to be a JavaScript developer. That's how I got a job. I'm serious, though. And I'm sure you've experienced this anytime you've been interviewing people, Uncle Bob. You get in 50 candidates that can't even write a for loop before you find somebody who can actually write any code at all.
Yeah, and that's not a new problem. When I was interviewing people in the 80s, the problem I would make them solve was the sieve of Eratosthenes, which is a doubly nested loop, very simple to write. And I would describe the algorithm to them, show them how it worked, ask them to write it in the language of their choice, and generally, well, only 1 out of 5 could manage it on a blackboard.
Yeah, it's kind of disheartening after. I mean, and I feel like that's probably how some of these unqualified people slip through, is that you've just been beaten down. You've gone through so many interviews. You're just like, whatever, hire somebody.
I imagine that sometimes happens. The standards, if you're going to double every 5 years, the standards can't be very high.
So I want to say, I started watching your videos, I want to say like 2011 sometime. There were 3, 4, maybe 5 videos out before I started purchasing them.
Oh, yeah.
But once I started watching them and I went and I read your books, completely turned around my development career.
Good.
And about, let's say, 5 years ago, I started really reading some of the old Dykstra papers. And I'm looking at the paper, I'm reading the paper, and I'm like, he's dealing with the same stuff that I'm dealing with right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we haven't learned anything. And it's been, you know, 60 years, almost.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it is fun to go back and read those old papers. I just read one a couple of months ago, because I was doing some research on Dykstra. And the parallels were just amazing, right? Same problems, same issues that he was facing back when he had 4K of core and was writing in a little assembly language. And yet, it's still the same stuff.
Yeah, I think my favorite line, and this is a paraphrase, but out of one of his papers, he says that his code was verified to be correct mathematically. So when there was an issue with the microprocessor that was being created running his code, they went and redid the microprocessor. Like, no, go fix your hardware because my code is perfect. I thought that was fantastic.
That would be, yeah.
So then what would be your advice to a brand new software developer, whether they just completed a 4-year degree, just completed a boot camp, just finished high school and know that this is the path that they want to take? What are the absolute minimum or what are the absolute required skills that a new developer should have, must have, will need to have in the future?
Oh, what a question to ask. I think the biggest skill is the skill of learning. To be a software developer, you have to be able to learn things quickly. You have to be able to replace whole bodies of knowledge out of in your mind with another set body of knowledge that's coming along. Probably a better word is integrate rather than replace. So you have to have this skill of constant learning, constant research, constant reading, constant fiddling and playing with new technologies, because the field is still young and still in transition, and new stuff comes along all the time. As you said, right? Since you've been doing the podcast, there's been 3 releases of JavaScript. So there's this massive churn that's going on all the time. Another very essential skill is to understand that the structure of a large system follows certain patterns Or rather, if the structure of a large system does not follow certain patterns, that system will become unmanageable over time. The cost of maintaining it will grow at some exponential rate. And so it's necessary to learn those patterns of how to assemble large-scale software. Most software developers coming out of school have no clue about that. No even idea. They have learned that software is for loops, if statements, and assembly and assignment statements, and not much more. And there's a very large body of knowledge that comes after that that they need to learn. Generally not taught in school, and when it is taught, if it's taught, it's taught by embittered old hands that have made the mistakes enough.
So, Bob, do you have any upcoming projects that you're working on or anything exciting that you'd like to discuss?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Well, I just finished one book called Clean Architecture, which is all about those big patterns that are essential to learn about how to put large systems together. So that book is in production, should be out in September. I've got three more books I need to write. The list keeps growing, which is a little disheartening. But maybe I'll get to the end of that list one day. Anyway, three other books coming. The next one will just be entitled Agile. I think it's time for a back-to-basics book on that. I'm still working on the video series, cleancoders.com. I put out a video every month. I've got, I think, 45 of them out now, or 48 of them out now. And there's probably another dozen or so that are in my head to do. And there's an article I want to write.
Fantastic. So we'll look for all of that in the near future.
Yeah, I think so.
What about any classes or lectures? I know you did a round of those recently, but how often do you repeat those?
Oh, I will go around and teach a class in Austin or in Philadelphia or in the city. We'll pick a city and we'll announce it. I think the next one coming up is going to be in North Carolina sometime or another. I'll also be in London, I think in October. I do those every other month or so. I just head out to a city and get, you know, 30 or 40 people into a room and yell at them for a few days.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for being a guest.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Appreciate everything you do for the community. Keep producing books and videos, and we'll keep watching and reading.
Okay, great.
All right, that was Robert C. Martin, a.k.a. Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob has been a software professional since 1970 and an international software consultant since 1990. This has been the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I'm John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.